This is the Daily Radio Ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Esther. Now here's Pastor Sandy in the book of Esther, chapter 7, with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
Haman hangs from the gallows he built for Mordecai. How quickly God turned the tables on the enemy of the Jews. Makes you think of Saddam Hussein, doesn't it? And you know, this has been the case throughout the history of the Jews. How quickly God has turned the tables on those who hate the Jews. Guys, God told Abraham that he would bless the nations that bless Israel, but he would also curse the nations that curse his people Israel. And God has been faithful to that promise. You know, it's interesting. Even though Hitler killed 6 million Jews, in an amazing way, God turned the tables on Hitler's intentions. For it was the Holocaust that would soften world opinion, that would convince the United Nations of the need for a Jewish homeland. Hitler, the man that wanted to annihilate the Jews, was the primary cause in the formation of the modern state of Israel. After the Holocaust, the United Nations realized that Israel needed its own homeland, that the Jews would never be safe unless they had their own country and their own nation. What a strange twist. As Germany crumbled, Israel was reborn. God is into turning the tables on those who hate the Jews. Well, chapter 8 begins. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. Esther gets Haman's wealth. Mordecai gets his job. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. And the story applies to you and me. God is faithful to his people. When circumstances become grim, when all hope seems lost, when your fate seems hopeless, don't forget Esther. How quickly God can turn the tables. Now Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, and implored him with tears to counteract the evil of Haman the Agite and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. Now, even though Haman is dead, Esther knows that the clock is still clicking on the annihilation of the Jews. In 12 months, a bounty will be out on the heads of the Jews, and assassins all over Persia will try to cash in. And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, "If it pleases the king, and I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agite, when he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen?" Verse 7. Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, "Indeed, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. You yourselves write a decree for the Jews as you please in the king's name and seal it with the king's signet ring, for a letter which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke." And remember, under Persian law, once a king signed an edict, it was irrevocable. Even the king himself couldn't reverse a prior decision that he had made. Once a decree was made by the king, it was final. But what Ahasuerus can do now is he can issue a new decree that will counterbalance his previous orders. Remember, because of Haman's insistence, he had ordered that all the Jews would be dead by the 12th month of the year. Now, though, he's going to issue a new order that's going to allow the Jews all over Persia to arm themselves and to defend themselves against their attackers. Verse 9. Here it describes how the Persian scribes record Ahasuerus' new orders. And one thing interesting about verse 9, good trivia question in the next time you play Bible trivia, here's something you throw out. What is the longest verse in the Bible? Esther chapter 8, verse 9, the verse we're about to read. Longest verse in the Bible, it's 81 words long. Ready? So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is in the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day. And it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the provinces from India to Ethiopia. The whole Persian Empire was put on notice. 127 provinces in all, to every province in its own script, to every people in their own language, and to the Jews in their own script and language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by couriers on horseback, riding on royal horses bred from swift steeds. The Persian Pony Express delivered this new decree all across Persia. By these letters, the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. On one day, in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is in the month of Adar. The Jews were even given first strike authority. In other words, they could launch a preemptive strike if it were necessary. And it's interesting, this has been the strategy of the modern state of Israel. You remember in 1981, as Saddam Hussein grew closer to producing a nuclear bomb, Israeli jets blew up his reactor in an overnight raid. They couldn't allow him to obtain nuclear weapons. They had to silence the threat before it could get launched. It was a preemptive strike. And this is the dilemma facing Israel today. Ahmadinejad and Iran are on the verge of having nuclear capabilities, and the Israelis cannot allow it to happen. A preemptive strike is on the horizon. When we were in Israel, when we were down at the Dead Sea, we saw F-16s flying right above us. They were doing their training exercises right down in the desert. We also saw some American military leaders on the ground. A chopper came in. When we were on top of Masada, a chopper came in and a group of, they were two-star generals, some three-star generals. They had gotten out of the chopper and they were up on top of Masada looking around. And our guide commented to me. He said, "Sandy, something is up." We started talking and he told me he believes that it's only months before the Israelis bomb those Iranian reactors. He said, "We've got to strike. We've got to strike first. We cannot allow this madman in Iran, this Jew hater in Iran, to develop these nuclear devices." We were talking. He's convinced that Israel is going to strike before Bush leaves office. It's interesting that today the Persian or the Iranian leader is Israel's enemy. In Esther's day, Ahasuerus was Israel's friend. He tells the Jews to mobilize themselves and to get ready, to take preemptive precaution if necessary, but to defend themselves. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province and published for all people so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. In other words, when this day arrives, the Jews are going to be loaded for bear. The couriers who rode on royal horses went out, hastened and pressed on by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Shushan, the citadel. So Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, the royal colors of Persia, with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. The Jews had light and gladness, joy and honor. And in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews because fear of the Jews fell upon them. Hey, if we can't beat them, we might as well join them. it became obvious to them that God's blessing was upon the Jewish people by this turn of fortune and this edict issued by Ahasuerus. Now, when D-Day rolls around, the Jews all over Persia are armed to the teeth. So in the 12th month, that is, in the month of Adar, in the 13th day, or if you're looking for a date you might recognize, March the 7th, 473 B.C., the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. On the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occurred, in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. The Jews gathered together in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could withstand them because fear of them fell upon all people. And all the officials of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and all those doing the king's work helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. Even the government resources were directed to help defend the Jews. For Mordecai was great in the king's palace, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces. For this man, Mordecai, became increasingly prominent. Mordecai had ascended to a top-level post, and so he was able to direct effort and resources to help the Jews defend themselves on the 13th day of Adar. Isn't it interesting how many Jews have ascended to high-level posts under Gentile rulers? You remember Joseph in Egypt? Remember him? You remember Daniel in Babylon? Here, Mordecai in Persia, Nehemiah in Judah, Henry Kissinger under Richard Nixon, Caspar Weinberger, a Jew, under Ronald Reagan, Madeleine Albright under Bill Clinton. FYI, we saw Madeleine last week in Jerusalem. She happened to be at the Wailing Wall the same day we were there. Back to Esther, verse 5. Thus the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with those who hated them. And in Shushan, the citadel, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. Also, the 10 sons of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, they killed, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. Verses 7 through 9 list Haman's 10 sons. On that day, the number of those who were killed in Shushan, the citadel, was brought to the king. And the king said to Queen Esther, "The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men in Shushan, the citadel, and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your petition? It shall be granted to you. Or what is your further request? It shall be done." Then Esther said, "If it pleases the king, let it be granted to the Jews who are in Shushan to do again tomorrow according to today's decree. And let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows." And so the king commanded this to be done. The decree was issued in Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. Remember verse 2? No one could withstand them. The Jewish counterattack goes so well that Esther asks for an additional day to finish the job, to totally annihilate the enemies of the Jews. Verse 15. And the Jews who were in Shushan gathered together again on the 14th day of the month of Adar and killed 300 men at Shushan. But they did not lay a hand on the plunder. The remainder of the Jews in the king's provinces gathered together and protected their lives, had rest from their enemies, and killed 75,000 of their enemies. But they did not lay a hand on the plunder. Haman was not the only anti-Semite in Persia. 75,000 prejudiced Persians were killed by these Jews when they launched their attack. This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day of the month, they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day as well as on the 14th, and on the 15th of the month, they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages who dwelt in the unwalled town celebrated the 14th day of the month of Adar with gladness and feasting as a holiday and for sending presents to one another. The victories all over Persia were obvious reasons for the Jews to celebrate. And the rest of chapter 9 discusses the institutionalization of this Jewish celebration. The Jews celebrate to this day, in honor of these events, what they call the Feast of Purim. Recall the word pur? It means lots. Haman threw them, but God controlled them. That was the story. Mordecai and Queen Esther established a celebration, and every year thereafter, even until today, the Jews commemorate the upper hand that God gave to them over their enemies. Verse 20. And Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters to all the Jews near and far, who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, as the days on which the Jews had rest from their enemies, as the month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them, and from mourning to a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, of sending presents to one another and gifts to the poor. Adar 14th and 15th became a perpetual holiday for the Jews. And to this day, the Jews celebrate this Feast of Purim. So the Jews accepted the custom which they had begun, as Mordecai had written to them, because Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to annihilate them and had cast pur, that is, the lot, to consume them and destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letter that this wicked plot which Haman had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. And so they called these days Purim after the name pur. Therefore, because of all the words of this letter, what they had seen concerning this matter, and what had happened to them, the Jews established and imposed it upon themselves and their descendants, and on all who should join them, that without fail they should celebrate these 2 days every year. Two new holidays were added to the Jewish calendar, Adar, the 14th and the 15th. Now, according to the written instructions and according to the prescribed time, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city, that these days of Purim should not fail to be observed among the Jews, and that the memory of them should not perish among their descendants. And to this day, the Feast of Purim is a time where the Jews gather together to rejoice and to make merry. Along with Hanukkah, the Feast of Purim is one of the two major Jewish feasts not required in the law of Moses, Hanukkah and Purim. Feast of Purim, as we've noted, occurs in the month of Adar, the 14th and the 15th, which is our February, March. If you need to jot it down on your calendar, in 2008, the Feast of Purim will occur on March the 20th and the 21st. Now, according to the Jewish Talmud, which was a writing of the traditions of the Jews, according to the Talmud, on Purim, a person is supposed to make merry. And according to Jewish tradition, a person is supposed to drink so much wine where they can't tell the differences between two phrases, curses be Haman and blessed be Mordecai. And so you're supposed to get so drunk that you can't understand those two phrases. That's one of the ways the Jews have ordained to celebrate Purim. Americans like to refer to Purim as the Jewish Mardi Gras. Sad to say, but that's what it's become among many of the Jews. Often beauty contests are held on the Feast of Purim in honor of Esther in the story. Now here's something very interesting. This was to be a holy day. But today, if you travel among secular Jews, they celebrate the Feast of Purim, but they do it almost the way we do some of our Christmas celebrations. There's a lot of drinking. There's a lot of revelry. It's just an excuse to party. People exchange gifts. This is how the Jews treat a holy day. They've turned it into a hollow day. And yet, can we point the finger? What have we done to our special day? What have we done to Christmas Day? Is there a more holy day on our Christian calendar than the day that God became a man, that Jesus came into this world, that heaven invaded earth? Is there a more holy day on the Christian calendar? And yet, what have we done with this day? For many people, it's just an excuse to party, even get drunk. They lace the eggnog, no less. Isn't it tragic that we've turned a day that is to be for worship and for celebration into an excuse to party? This is exactly what the Jews have done with the Feast of Purim. Purim is also a big occasion for the children, which is our Christmas. Kids dress up in crazy costumes during the Feast of Purim. They have Purim parades where they march together. On this day, the story of Esther is always read in the synagogue. And every time the name Haman is read, everyone does what? They boo and they hiss and they shake noisy rattlers that they call groggers. Whenever the word Mordecai gets mentioned, everyone offers up cheers, right? Verse 29. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter about Purim. And Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus with words of peace and truth to confirm these days of Purim at their appointed time, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had prescribed for them, and as they had decreed for themselves and their descendants concerning matters of their fasting and lamenting. So the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim, and it was written in the book. And Purim is still celebrated 2,400 years later. Here's a poem that sort of sums up the book of Esther. Man proposes, God disposes. All things his design fulfill. Every human wrath, unconscious, serves to execute his will. This the goal of all the ages. Highways, byways, higher bend. And despite all foes and factions, God is victor in the end. So man's festival of Purim, read in faith's illumined sense, shall be seen in realms eternal as the feast of providence. Esther is all about God's providence. Chapter 10. King Ahasuerus imposed tribute or tax on the land and on the islands of the sea. And now all the acts of his power and his might and the account of the greatness of Mordecai to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus and was great among the Jews and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people and speaking peace to all his countrymen. Throughout history, God's providence has protected and prodded his people. I love these words by Alexander McLaren. He says, "This book of Esther does not say much about God, but his person broods over it all and is the real spring that moves the movers that are seen. It is all a lesson of how God works out his purposes through men that themselves are to be working out theirs." Isn't that interesting? And what about God's providence in your life? We could spend hours discussing ways that God has providentially intervened in our lives and directed circumstances, often mysteriously so, to fulfill his plans and his purposes for us. Always remember, God has a purpose. And you'll see its accomplishment. It'll work out in due time.
You've been listening to Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams, here at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy spoke to us from the book of Esther today. Esther's life did not go exactly as planned. She was the definition of a fish out of water for so many years until she aligned with God's purpose for her life. From that day forward, she led a purpose-driven and meaningful testimony for God. Her example of following God's will for her life led others to become living witnesses, and had a tremendous impact on faith as we know it today. You may not be completely sure of God's will for your life. There will be times you feel led clearly, and then all of a sudden you realize the target is moved. Have you aligned with God's purpose for your life? If you'd like to hear more messages like this one, head over to sandyadams.org. Once again, that's sandyadams.org. While you're there, check out Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain under the About tab. If you're in the Atlanta area, why not come visit us? We have services at 9:15 and 11:15 a.m. There's more information and directions at sandyadams.org. Well, that's about all we have time for today, but we look forward to our time together again very soon. There's so much more to share with you as Pastor Sandy teaches again from the Word of God on the next edition of Sandy Adams Radio.